Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is U.S. versus Beneby et al. And Mr. Carlson.
Your Honors, counsel for the government, my co-counsel, my name is Kent Carlson, and I was appointed to represent Fernando De La Torre in this case. The argument that I'm presenting this morning is the exclusion of defendants De La Torre and Beneby from the trial of their case, and the effect that that had not just on them, but on the other defendants who were on trial. We are asking this court, suggesting to this court, that the Constitution and Rule 43 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure provides a bright line that requires a defendant to be present in court at jury selection, act disruptively in front of the jury, be warned that his continued disruptive behavior and behavior that is such that would prevent the trial from going on in his presence occur, and then before a defendant can be excluded from the trial.
Mr. Carlson, under your theory, does the defendant have a right to be present physically in front of every prospective juror?
When you say every prospective juror, you mean the veneer or
yes,
the actual selected juror?
The whole panel. The whole panel of potential jurors.
I think the answer to that question is yes.
Well, let me give you a often jury selection will be done in smaller groups, among other things, to prevent the prospect for unexpected statements from prospective jurors themselves, or in this kind of a case, from defendants, from tainting the rest of the panel.
In this district where I try most of my cases, we have the entire veneer brought into the courtroom.
That's not constitutionally required, though, is it?
It is not. But
okay.
And I was addressing the question in that context. If jury selection were to start in a smaller group basis, I would say the answer to the question is no.
Okay. So if there's no constitutional or Rule 43 right to be physically present for the questioning of every single prospective juror, in other words, you can waive that right by misbehavior, why is there a right to be physically present for the first group?
I think the answer to that is I think Rule 43 plainly and clearly provides that.
Well, what's the moment that is the beginning of trial as you read Rule 43? Because you're asking us to draw a very bright line. What is the beginning of trial?
I think the point in which the jury veneer is brought into the courtroom.
So you've just said now there is a right to be face-to-face with all of the jurors?
Well, I don't think all of the jurors, if you're picking a jury in a piecemeal basis. But I think the minute jury selection starts when whatever the entire veneer or whatever portion of the veneer is brought in.
How do you reconcile that with the, I think it was the Brown case where the defendant was acting up before jury selection began?
If that's
and was held in contempt. Mm.
If that is the case I'm thinking of, and I think a defendant who acts up in before the jury is brought in, contempt is certainly an appropriate sanction. I think a defendant has the right, though, to be present when the jury is brought in, absent.
But only a few of them is under your theory, right?
Well, I don't think, in light of the different ways juries can be picked,
You're asking us to draw a line that applies across the board.
And I think the only way you can draw that line is whatever the number of jurors that are brought in for the beginning of jury selection, whether that be 12 jurors, whether that be 50 jurors. The defendant has a right to be present for that. If the defendant acts up at that point...
So he's got a right to act up in front of the jurors.
I believe so.
Let me ask you, this: the judge in this case, Judge Castillo, made the final decision to exclude these two defendants, if I recall correctly, on February 5th. Is that
That's
right?
That's correct.
The trial, the jury selection began on the morning of the 6th, correct?
I'm not sure. It was not the same day. I'm not positive of the date.
I believe it was the next day. Were you the trial counsel?
I was not.
Suppose we disagree with you about the exact moment that trial begins. And suppose we say that it begins when the case is called, perhaps a few moments before the first group of prospective jurors are brought into the courtroom. And the defendant acts out then. I guess where I'm headed with this is, in essence, why should we be terribly troubled if that confrontation and misbehavior and exclusion occur the day before jury selection occurs rather than after jury selection occurs?
Because I believe when a defendant comes in, what a defendant does, not in front of the jury, whether it be days before jury selection or the morning before jury selection, before the jurors are brought in, is not a valid predictor of what a defendant is going to do in front of the jury. And I believe this court in the Watkins case actually indicated that there was no evidence in that case that merely because he acted up as he was brought into the courtroom while the jury wasn't yet president, that was not necessarily a valid indicator of what he may do in front of a jury.
If not, then why weren't those defendants willing to say so? Why weren't Mr. Benabe and Mr. Della Torre willing to tell the judge, I'll behave in front of the court, in front of the jury?
Well, I cannot speak into Mr. Benabe's mind. Mr. Della Torre filed with the court an affidavit in which he said, I won't answer your question, Judge Castillo, because I'm afraid for my life. And one of the things that is interesting about this case is Mr. Della Torre had been a cooperator in this case. And at the last minute changed his mind and no longer wished to cooperate and went to trial. And one of the reasons was he said he was afraid for his life. He said he didn't want to make any promises to Judge Castillo out of fear for his life, but that he had done so in writing and tendered an affidavit to Judge Castillo in which he said that he would cooperate during the course of the trial. As a matter of fact, on the morning, and the government miscites this in their brief at page 42, neither Della Torre nor Benabe refused to come down to the courtroom the morning of jury selection. They were up in the marshal's lockup. What happened is their lawyers went up there. They would not talk to their lawyers. They never refused to come to court. As a matter of fact, Mr. Della Torre, after having submitted the affidavit, asked the marshal service, where are my civilian clothes? So he was anticipating.
Where do we find that in the record?
It was the morning of jury selection, Your Honor, and I...
Presumably all this happened off the record, however.
I believe it was put on the record in front of Judge Castillo as the defendant's lawyers came back down to the courtroom. It was put on the record that Mr. Della Torre had asked for his civilian clothes, had asked the marshals for his civilian clothes.
The transcript for the 6th?
Yes.
Okay.
I just don't have the exact page site. But I think in that situation, that even prompts a further inquiry from Judge Castillo as to whether Della Torre had promised or had not promised. And so I don't think you can find in that situation a knowing waiver of his right to be present.
Well, that may be true in another context where the defendant's behavior is isolated or episodic, but this was a long-standing pattern and practice on the part of these defendants of willful obstruction of the pretrial proceedings based on entirely frivolous grounds. And you know, we ordinarily give district courts substantial discretion to deal with these sorts of situations, and that's very clear as a constitutional matter and also as a matter of the rules that the district court has substantial discretion to deal with these sorts of situations. And so Judge Casilla was entitled to reject that as a sign of the defendant's good faith, which you're urging us to accept it as a sign of the defendant's good faith, but based on the history, there was no basis for that.
Well, there are two issues there. Number one is Judge Castillo brought some of this on himself. At virtually each and every court appearance, Judge Castillo asked these defendants if they had anything they wanted to say, and he continued to allow it to happen.
And you're saying that was a mistake?
I'm not saying that that was a mistake, but I think what happened in the mind of some of these defendants is they believed that they had the right to be able to do that. And Judge Castillo himself even found that they were polite, that their comments were made in good faith, albeit ill-advised. These were not situations where these were defendants getting up, threatening Judge Castillo, threatening harm, screaming, yelling, anything like that. They were raising, albeitly frivolous, issues.
Repeatedly.
Repeatedly. And in some instances, and it was cited in my brief, in one instance, Judge Castillo asked Mr. Dellatore to be quiet. He politely said he would, and then Judge Castillo went and asked him whether he had anything else he wanted to raise, and he raised another issue. These are the kinds of things that went on here, and this their activity in pretrial raising issues is not an indicator that they're going to disrupt the jury
but
in any way.
But they were questioned at length by the district court about their willingness to desist from these tactics during the course of the trial once the jury was in the courtroom, and they pointedly refused to agree. So that's, you know, it's essentially the equivalent of a positive assurance to the court that they would be disruptive and would continue to make these disruptive claims about being a corporate sovereign and the court not having jurisdiction and et cetera.
With respect to Dellatore, he submitted an affidavit to the court, which the court said it accepted, that said in there, I promise that I won't disrupt the trial. If Judge Castillo had read that...
I'm reminded of the fact, though, that we don't take, for example, written plea agreements. We got to do that face-to-face, right?
Correct.
If I'm being told in writing I'm going to behave by a defendant who's been disruptive, and he won't say that to my face in the solemnity of the courtroom, why should I take that affidavit at face value?
Well, if what Judge Castillo had done was one of two things, number one, said to Mr. Dellatore, okay, you've submitted this to me in writing, you say in here you're going to not disrupt the trial, are you promising you're not going to disrupt the trial? I think a simple question could have answered that. Or at worst...
Well, he asked that question many, many times.
But not after looking at Mr. Dellatore's affidavit. Secondly, when Mr. Dellatore explained to him that it was out of fear for his life, Judge Castillo could have said, I would like to talk to Mr. Dellatore without all the other people present.
The judge is not required to accept that representation, particularly based on the context and the history here.
Well, I think when I'm not saying a judge is necessarily forced to accept that, but I think at that point there is some further inquiry that he needs to make if he's going to make a finding that they knowingly and voluntarily waive their right to be present.
Why should that be the rule in the context of this trial, based on the pattern and practice of these two defendants' behavior?
Again, because I don't think what they did pretrial is a valid indicator of what they would do in front of the jury. I just don't think
Why is the district court entitled to disagree?
Because I think if you look at the Allen case, It talks about conduct that is so disruptive that the trial can't proceed in their absence. Merely raising in front of a judge a frivolous legal argument is a little bit different than acting up in front of a jury.
There is a lot more to it than that. I mean, they persisted in this and were continuously disruptive of the judge's attempts to rule on pretrial matters. I mean, there was a lot more to this than just the assertion of this frivolous defense.
Well, there was no abusive language. There was no disrespect. It was polite, and Judge Castillo even found it was polite. And he even found that they, in good faith, believed the things that they were saying.
This is a typical tax protester effort. That's where it comes from. These are the kind of things that tax protesters say, right?
Probably.
And they've consistently tried to use it to taint jurors, that is, tax protesters have, in cases, by speaking and making those kind of arguments to the jury. Here, Judge Castillo wasn't going to let it happen. And what he said was, if they would be able to return if they would indicate that they will not speak in front of the prospective jurors or the final jury without the permission of the court, as long as they'll abide by that simple courtroom behavior. Didn't talk about disruption. It talked about tainting the jury by making these frivolous arguments.
But I think the standard that the Supreme Court in Allen set down is different than that. It requires behavior that is so disruptive that the trial can't be held in their presence. And I don't think that that's comes even close to what we had in this case. And there was no indication that this would continue on in front of the jury. In fact, the Allen case, it was a pro se defendant who was getting up arguing frivolous points in front of the jury. We didn't have that here. We never got that far. And I respectfully suggest that the pretrial behavior here was just not a valid predictor of what was going to happen in front of a jury.
That seems like a great leap of faith you were asking the district court to take after the efforts that he described to get a panel of about 130 or 100 jurors screened for long trials, after getting I don't know how many defense counsel's calendars cleared for 3 or 4 months, so that if something blew up the way it had in the Manny case that he mentioned in the jury selection, you'd probably have to start over again 6 months later at least, right?
That may very well be the case, but I think
let me get at it this way, Mr. Carlson. If we were to agree with you on the handling of Benabe and Della Torre here, we would have to tell the district judge what he should have done differently in facing what I hope you would agree is a very challenging dilemma with these defendants. What would you have us instruct the trial judge to do differently?
Well, and I have two comments. With respect to Mr. Della Torre, I think at a minimum he had a duty to inquire further. As to the other defendants, I quite respectfully believe that the instruction to Judge Castillo should be to impanel a jury, bring the defendants in front of the jury. If they act up in front of the jury in such a manner that Judge Castillo does not believe that the trial can go on in their presence, he has to warn them of that. And if they continue to act up, then and only then can he exclude them from the courtroom. I see my time is up.
Mr. Beal?
May it please the court. I'd like to start by being clear what, I'm going to address the aiding and abetting RICO conspiracy instruction. And I'd like to start by reminding the court that conviction of, for aiding and abetting is this results in the same punishment as conviction as a principal. Now, the court gave the pattern aiding and abetting instruction that a person must knowingly associate with a criminal activity, participate in the activity, and try to make it succeed. And our objection with respect to Mr. Benabi is that our contention is that the evidence showed that he participated in the gang in an administrative capacity, and under that instruction could have been convicted if the jury saw that he had some association, he was a member of the gang, he participated through some administrative process and wanted the gang to be successful in the sense of continuing to have membership and meetings and so on, and completely ignoring the predicate acts, which are the essence of RICO. And we know that pattern instruction books, this court has observed, often fail to provide useful instructions. Now, that we offered an alternative instruction, the core of which was a statement that the defendant must knowingly assist in the commission of at least two predicate acts. This gives real meaning to the aiding and abetting instruction, but the question is it a correct statement of the law? And I submit that it is a correct statement of the law. First of all, in aiding and abetting a conspiracy, this court has repeatedly held that you don't aid and abet the formation of the conspiratorial agreement. Rather, you have to take some action that shows your intent to assist the underlying offense. That's Irwin and Galiffa. And similarly, the standard aiding and abetting instruction itself requires action, not just agreement on the part of the defense, because you have to participate in the offense and try and make it succeed. In other words, you have to act and not simply have, not simply try to facilitate the agreement. And what does participation mean? The essence of RICO is increasing the punishment for committing the predicate acts through an enterprise. Now, in this case, there were no unconsummated predicate acts. All the predicate acts were actually carried out. So if participation does not encompass the predicate acts, then it allows for conviction as a principal of someone who has not violated the essence of the offense. And that's what our instruction encompasses, requiring the defendant to knowingly assist in the commission of at least two predicate acts.
How is that consistent with Salinas?
Excuse me? Yes. Salinas
It says the opposite of what you're proposing.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. Salinas is a Supreme Court case where the Texas sheriff and his principal deputy accepted bribes for allowing an inmate to have conjugal visits. And the court held that the evidence showed that the sheriff committed at least two acts of racketeering activity when he accepted numerous bribes, and Salinas knew about and agreed to facilitate the scheme, and which I think is what you're getting at. He agreed. But this is a conviction for RICO conspiracy, not aiding and abetting. And Salinas goes on to say that the RICO conspiracy statute, 1962D, broadened conspiracy coverage by omitting the requirement of a predicate act, of an overt act. The conspiracy statute broadened conspiracy coverage by omitting the requirement of an overt act. I would submit that when you put aiding and abetting on top of a RICO conspiracy, you reinstate the requirement of an overt act, because under Irwin and Galiffa, you have to act. You can't just facilitate the formation of the agreement. You can't do what Salinas allowed the conviction of the deputy for, And the aiding and abetting instruction itself requires participation and trying to make the endeavor succeed. So you have to have action. You have to have an overt act.
Well, Mr. Beal, how about, I mean, obviously, the way you're describing an individual conspirator's agreement to participate in two predicate acts is at least one way that he can join the conspiracy or aid and abet the conspiracy. But why isn't it equally a violation, for example, for somebody like Benabe, who sort of comes in from corporate headquarters in Chicago to the regional meeting, the branch meeting, and tries to make peace among the juniors and the seniors and the retired members, to try to bring peace so that the team will all pull together in its energies towards distributing drugs and shooting members of the Latin Kings?
Because, Your Honor, the government chose how to charge this conspiracy, and it charged it as a RICO conspiracy, and the essence of RICO is the predicate acts. And Mr. Benabe, there is no evidence that he knew about the predicate acts before they happened, that he participated in any...
Not the specific ones, no.
Correct, Judge.
But it's the whole theory that, I mean, RICO is not just about predicate acts. The theory is that the organization, the enterprise, is far more dangerous than isolated predicate acts. And it's the organization, exactly what Benabe was facilitating, that makes it so dangerous.
Well, there are two parts. There's commission of predicate acts through an enterprise. You have two components. And what I submit is allowing the pattern instruction, you encompass the enterprise, but you can basically skip over the predicate acts. You can allow a conviction for someone for whom there's no connection shown to the predicate acts, and that shouldn't, considering the severity of the penalties under RICO, that shouldn't be permitted. And that's, I think, why Rastelli continues to be good law with respect to aiding and abetting. Rastelli does not continue to be good law with respect to the defendant having to personally commit or agree to himself committing the predicate acts. Our contention is that it essentially guts the core of RICO by enabling the commission of predicate acts to be basically not a part of the jury's decision with respect to a particular defendant under aiding and abetting. And I submit that's wrong, that you have to have both the enterprise and the predicate acts encompassed in a conviction, and that the pattern instruction allows the jury not to do that, whereas our proposed instruction would require the jury to deal with the predicate acts as well as the enterprise.
How does that reasoning apply? Let me characterize sort of what I understand the government to be arguing. To a role for Benabe in which he says, in essence, I want to help you guys deal drugs and kill Latin Kings, and helps them do that by making peace. He doesn't know about any of the specific predicate acts, but he's kept the organization healthy, vibrant, energetic, so that it'll go out and do those things without him knowing specific details. Why isn't that as much a target of RICO as somebody who helps plan the murder of a specific gang member?
Because the RICO statute structures itself around enterprise and predicate acts. That's the essence of the RICO statute. And you're allowing the government to seek a conviction by just skipping one part of the statute, which I contend to be the core part of the statute. They picked what predicate acts to use. They define the conspiracy. And I would submit that you can't allow a RICO conviction where you allow the government to avoid one of the two core aspects of the statute.
This sounds to me like an argument that aider and abettor theories of liability aren't applicable in the RICO context.
Well, it's difficult in the RICO context because you're, You know, you have this complex, the RICO conspiracy, with all with all its complexities. How do you aid and abet that? I mean, it's not a good fit, quite frankly, because you have. I'm not going to be able to rattle off I did the RICO instructions, but all the requirements. Trying to aid and abet that the complex RICO structure. That's why you have to go to action, because for a jury to go through the mental gyrations of aiding in the formation of a RICO conspiracy with all its requirements of continuity plus and predicate acts and enterprises is just inconceivable. So it's not a good fit. Yes, I'm not saying it can't be done under any circumstances, but it's not a good fit. And our proposed instruction, or something very close to it, would hold the government to its proof for a statute that brings the severe penalties that RICO does. I would finally say I argue in the brief, and I think it's adequately covered there, that this is not a harmless. This would not be harmless error because of Mr. Benabi's particular role in the enterprise. And I would finally say on the competency issue, I think it's an important issue, but it's adequately briefed. I'd be happy to answer any questions on it. But if the court doesn't have any, then I'd reserve the balance of our time.
Thank you, Mr. Beal. I might interrupt us here in just a minute, that I see our circuit executive has escorted a number of judges from Russia into the courtroom. Mr. Collins, would you like to introduce, not by name, but just where they're from?
Trial judges from Penza and Belgorod. And they're here for the whole week. They're spending time here in the federal courts as well as in the circuit court of Cook County. And it's part of the Open World program funded by Congress.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you very much. Mr. Fulton?
May it please the court. My opponent is arguing for a rule that would require the district court to allow Mr. De La Torre and Mr. Benabi two chances at tainting the jury. One before he gets a warning, and then the second after he gets a warning and before he's excluded. We don't read the Constitution or the rules of federal criminal procedure to require that. And that would hamstring a district court facing a difficult, long trial such as this. The district court here clearly had the discretion and the power to deal with Mr. De La Torre and Benabi in the way that it did, and did not abuse its discretion in doing so. Mr. De La Torre and Mr. Benabi had a, as we've set out in the brief, this long history of behavior that, while it wasn't screaming and yelling, was maybe even more disturbing, because it went, as Your Honor pointed out, like tax protester arguments, it went to the central question of a trial that the judge had to be concerned with, namely, who was going to run the courtroom. The arguments of De La Torre and Benabi were to contest. They contested the jurisdiction of the court. They contested the power of the district court. They thought the entire proceeding was illegal and unlawful and illegitimate. And at no time in the weeks leading up and the days leading up to this trial was there any indication that De La Torre and Benabi were going to submit to the power of the district court,
Mr.
as
Fulton,
it conducted the trial.
In your brief, I was looking for a response to the Rule 43 argument that the defendants made. The only thing I really saw was maybe it's harmless, that if there was a violation, it was harmless. First of all, on Rule 43, is there an argument that this is somehow not a violation of Rule 43?
I think there is, Judge. I think
how?
That De La Torre and Benabi waived their right under Rule 43 to attend their trial. in the days leading up to it. And the district court made that determination.
The Supreme Court has made it clear that Rule 43, I mean, in one way to read Crosby anyway, is that Rule 43 provides the exclusive manner by which a defendant may be deemed to have waived his presence at trial, and we don't have them present at the beginning of trial here.
They weren't in the courtroom at the beginning of the trial. They were in the lockup. That's right.
They're not present in the trial.
Right. Now,
I don't want to play semantic games. They weren't there.
Right.
How is that not a violation of Rule 43? I understand we can talk about harmlessness, but how is it not a violation of Rule 43?
Well, I don't read Crosby to understand that Rule 43 may only be waived after an initial presence. Rule 43 does provide for a waiver after they were initially present, but to require the initial presence in order to effect the waiver would put the district court judge, in this catch-22 situation where in order to get the waiver, they have to be present, but when they're present, they contain the jury, and so on and so forth.
Well, the language and the structure of the rule suggests otherwise, and I think that's what the Crosby Court was concerned with. It sets forth in the first provision when the defendant's presence is required, and that plainly says that, you know, every trial stage, which, if not explicitly includes, implicitly includes the beginning of trial, right? And jury selection is listed. And then the exception is denominated as circumstances under which the defendant's presence, continued presence, can be waived. So the way the rule is structured and the text of the rule sort of runs against the grain of your argument as a textual matter. I don't know whether you're arguing for some sort of, you know, purposivist reading of the rule as opposed to a literal reading of the rule, or whether you're going to rely on your harmless error argument.
Well, Crosby was dealing with a defendant who had fled well before trial.
Right. It can be distinguished on its facts, but the court was interpreting Rule 43.
Right. And it also did not say that there were no other constitutional ways to waive your right to be present.
Right. Your constitutional argument is stronger than your rule-based argument.
Right. So to the extent that Rule 43, if you read Rule 43 to put the judge in this box of having to have them present at jury selection, able to taint the jury, then I think we have to deal with our harmless error argument, which is very strong. I mean, there's no question that had they been present in court, I think they would have continued their behavior. There's no reason to think that had they been brought down from the lockup on the day, February 6th, the first day of trial, they would have given an answer any different to the ones that they had given, or non-answers that they had given. Mr. Carlson refers to this affidavit that Dellatore had filed, what he called his affidavit of truth, and I just want to refer Your Honor to it. It's in the record at document number 1046. It's attached to record number 1046, I should say. And Judge Castillo did refer to it in his opinion on the post-trial motions dealing with this issue. It's true that Mr. Dellatore says in that affidavit, which is, I think, dated the 2nd of February, the undersigned intends to fully cooperate with the court's proceedings during and throughout the course of the trial. He does say that. However, he continues to say that the undersigned, that is Dellatore, is willing to review any orders issued of the court, but the order must be provided to Dellatore by counsel who will establish that they are in fact representing him in his private capacity. And before dilatory, before the undersigned, can accept and review any order issued by the court, these orders must bear the undersigned's true name and current sovereign and secured party creditor status.
Right. I don't think the issue in this case about the defendant's removal from the courtroom it turns on the adequacy of the record to support the district judge's finding of a waiver under the rule. I don't think that's really the issue. We've got a time and place question here, and what does the rule require as to the time and place of the waiver determination? Does it require the court to bring the jury in and have all the defendants physically present in the courtroom and give them the opportunity to disrupt before making the waiver finding? Or can the judge make that waiver finding before jury selection commences? That's the interpretive question right on the table. Not the question of the adequacy of the record to support the waiver finding.
Watkins suggests that Rule 43 protection, that is the right to be present, can be waived prior to jury selection, that is on the day of trial. Watkins was excluded from the courtroom before the voir dire had begun. His conviction was reversed not because of the timing of that, but because of the adequacy of the judge's record about how voluntary and knowing his waiver was. If that's true, and we think Watkins is correct, then I would suggest that making that determination the day before is no different.
And how does that aspect of Watkins and your argument square with the text of the rule?
That the rule can be waived. The right to be present can be waived.
Let me come at this a little bit differently. Can I just confirm, if I got the chronology right, that the final exclusion occurred on the 5th and jury selection began on the 6th?
That's correct. There was a status on the 5th at which one final chance was given.
Face-to-face with all the defendants,
face-to-face, right?
Okay.
On the 6th, the jury selection began. That morning, they refused to come down from the lockup.
Okay.
Let me add that the judge continued to inquire during the course of the trial whether there was any change in heart on behalf of Dellatore and Behaven.
So the door stayed open.
The door stayed open. Mm-hmm. The district court made available to them by way of closed-circuit TV the proceedings at the MCC if they cared to watch the trial. As the judge indicated in ruling on the post-trial motions, they did not avail themselves of that. So they chose not to attend the trial. They knew it was going to happen. They knew the consequences of not being there, and they deliberately chose not to do so.
How is that different from Crosby?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How is that different from Crosby?
Well, Crosby had fled.
He chose not to attend the trial. He knew the consequences.
The difficulty in Crosby was imputing to that defendant knowledge that the trial was going to happen.
He knew the trial date.
Well, that's probably why he fled. But the difficulty was, I think the Supreme Court talks about the difficulty in saying that he absolutely knew for certain it was going to be held even in absentia, whereas these defendants were told explicitly, this trial is going to happen even if you're not there. It's going ahead. So they knew there to a certainty that the trial would be held without them, whereas the Supreme Court couldn't say that about the defendant in Crosby.
How were they to convey their agreement to comply with the judge's direction to the judge? How were they to convey that?
Well, they could have done it just as every other defendant in the case did, which is to say, I agree, Your Honor, that I will speak only through counsel or unless otherwise...
Once they were at MCC, how would they convey
it? Well, they could have talked to their lawyers. The record shows that they refused to speak to their lawyers. Or they could have...
That's part of my question. They refused to talk to their lawyers.
Right. They did refuse to talk to their lawyers. They could have also communicated themselves by writing a letter or filing something, not like the affidavit of truth, but something that actually suggested that they really did agree to abide by the court's rule and is respect the court's power and its jurisdiction.
Ms. Fullerton, let me ask you. We've talked all morning about the risk of tainting the jury. But I guess I'm a little skeptical about just how great that risk was. If there's just, you know, one outburst, the judge controls it. Thinking, for example, apparently there was an outburst from Defendant Guzman during closing argument, and the judge sat on it right away, as I understand the record, gave the appropriate kinds of instructions. It was raised in the post-trial motions. It hasn't been raised on appeal, if I recall correctly, out of all the issues I'm trying to keep track of
right here.
Things like that happen now and then. It's not that terrible a problem. Manny was a pretty exaggerated case
right
by comparison. So I guess, isn't there an argument here that this was a little overly protective?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think when Dellatore and Minami refused to signal their compliance and respect for the court's power and jurisdiction, if the judge had gone forward despite that, everyone in that courtroom would have been on pins and needles. And the trial lasted, at least 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
There were multiple defendants, of course, multiple lawyers. Never knowing, they would have been on pins and needles, never knowing what was going to happen and when. Basically, it would have armed Dellatore and Benabe with the ability to achieve a mistrial or at least a severance or
let's test the premise of that. If they had made the sort of frivolous assertions about the court's lack of jurisdiction over them because they're corporate sovereigns and et cetera, you know, the posse comitatus arguments, if they had made those during jury selection or after the jury was impaneled and sworn and, you know, at any point during that two-month process, would that have been grounds for a mistrial?
That may not have.
Probably
but
not.
But there may have been. There was no reason, as I said, who knew what was going to come out of their mouths, given their attitude towards the court and their sort of non-compliant behavior. The other defendants, of course, didn't want any. They were worried about what their associates might do.
That's why I'm asking my question. If the taint would have been such that a mistrial would have been the only remedy at that point, I mean, the uncertainty is not enough, right?
No, but it was enough. The uncertainty was enough to require them to answer the question, are you going to respect my power and authority as we go forward in this trial? And when they couldn't say that, they refused to say it. Against this background of fencing with the court, not answering questions, refusing to speak only when called upon, the judge had to take the measures that were reasonable under the circumstance. You know, this court has admonished district courts in Manny and other cases to take control of the courtroom. The steps that this judge took were reasonable and we think ought to be affirmed.
I take it the record supports the proposition that they never asserted or made any effort to regain the right to be present.
I'm sorry.
These two defendants never
attempted
to regain the right to be
present.
No,
they did not.
Could you address the point that Mr. Dellatore's counsel made about whether there was an actual refusal to come down from the lockup on the morning of jury selection?
I don't recall the exact language that was on the transcript of February 6th, but they were brought over from the MCC. They were in the lockup. All the other defendants were brought to the courtroom. I believe that there was a report that they refused to be brought. And refused to meet with their lawyers. That's what I recall about the record on that, Your Honor. Certainly, if they had been willing to come to court, I suggest they would have been there.
Was the government invited to take a position on this waiver question at the time that the judge decided it?
Your Honor, I don't remember that.
You were the trial counsel?
I was not, no.
You were not, so.
I don't remember that. I think there was some discussion of it. It didn't unfold. It didn't happen all at once.
Right.
On February 5th, of course. This had been a matter building for some time. So I think there was some discussion about what the judge was going to do. One thing that the judge considered but rejected was having the defendants gagged or bound,
right.
Things like that.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that it had been discussed over the weeks and the multiple status.
But you don't recall if the government took an affirmative position about whether the defendants had to be present at the commencement of jury selection?
I think our position was that they had waived their right to be there. I don't recall exactly, Judge.
The main thrust, I gather, was that the judge was concerned that they would, without seeking leave or having permission granted, speak out to the jury, or at least in the jury's presence, espouse these particular ideas about sovereign human beings or whatever.
That's right, and that they wouldn't accept the representation of their lawyers, whom they rejected it because they didn't put forward the frivolous arguments, and that they wouldn't also agree to the or submit to the judge's orders about how the trial was going to be conducted, namely, that they couldn't speak out. So there was a the district court was concerned about their having them in the courtroom for multiple reasons, and the basic one being they wouldn't submit to the power of the court to run the courtroom by speaking out, by not allowing their attorneys to represent them, by getting into conflicts and debating with the court about its orders or its questions, or debating with their lawyers about what theories that they should be putting forward.
I suppose if it had happened, if the judge could have held them in contempt.
And Judge Castillo considered that. But of course, De La Torre and Benave were facing life sentences. And as Judge Castillo concluded, the threatening power of holding them in contempt just didn't have any the threat of holding them in contempt just wasn't going to have any power over them. So unless there's more questions on this issue, I'd like to turn to the aiding and abetting issue. And just first of all say we think that the instruction was correct. There was no abuse of discretion in giving the instruction. Certainly there was no error. Any error there was harmless because Benabe, by his position, he was the, as Judge Hamilton pointed out, he was the top-ranking member of the Deuces on the street. He was, I believe, the number 3-ranking member of the Insane Deuces. He ran the gang outside of prison. He hosted or ran meetings in the summer of 2002, at which his power and authority over the gang were very evident. If you read the transcripts, it's very clear who's running those meetings. It's Bolivar Benave on behalf of the gang. He is a full conspirator in the gang. He certainly knew what the gang was about, what it was trying to achieve, what its individual members were tasked with doing. He knew about the drug dealing. He knew about the murder. He was in on the plot to murder rival gang members and Ambrose gang, the Latin Kings.
Mr. Fullerton, could I ask you a question about two different parts of your brief? Defendant Guzman argued, we haven't heard about it today, but Guzman argues that there was insufficient evidence against him to prove the RICO conspiracy. And I understood your argument in response to that point to be, oh, yeah, we've got him tied to, we've got proof of his direct personal involvement in two of the predicate acts of violence.
Three, I believe.
Okay. And I guess I didn't see any reference in that discussion to the aiding and abetting instruction discussion where you're saying we don't need to prove this to support the claim against any individual. But maybe I'm missing something here.
I may not have put that in the brief, Judge. Obviously, space was a concern.
For everybody.
Again, Guzman, the evidence was that Guzman had tried to kill Shermaine Shamley and Latin King. He was, the evidence is overwhelming that Guzman was a member of the gang, a conspirator, and tried to, you know, forward this RICO enterprise.
But would you agree, though, that if you're right about the instruction issue,
they could certainly also have convicted
that it was not necessary to provide that individual proof of personal involvement in the in those predicate acts?
I believe that's right.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So
let me ask you, if I could, another question about an issue that hasn't been argued yet by the defense, but it's in the briefs. Guzman's severance argument talks about questioning of a police officer about a statement Delatorre had made, if I'm remembering correctly. And I believe the question was that Delatorre had been talking about being in a car with one other person who, if all the details were known, he said it was Guzman at the time. There's an obvious Bruton problem there. And the prosecutor asked, who was he with? Isn't that an extremely dangerous way to ask that question and risk a mistrial? Particularly when you can lead under these circumstances, and what you drew, it's like bait for an objection from Guzman's lawyers. I was very troubled by that incident.
Your Honor, I think there would be safer ways to ask that question. Leading would be one of them. I think that as the record shows, though, the prosecutor and the witness had gone over this issue. We're aware of the risk.
That's why it's bait for objection. I understand the explanation that was given.
Mm-hmm. But I think that, as I recall, though, it wasn't just that discussion was not just confined to the prosecutor and the witness. I think that the defense and the court also were aware that the answer would be redacted.
Well, yeah, but when the question gets asked that way,
in an open-ended way,
and you'd be here, if it had happened the other way, you'd be making a waiver argument for failure to make an objection, right?
Yeah, forfeiture argument. That's
yeah.
Right.
Forfeiture. Okay.
But as it turned out, though, Judge, the answer Christian Guzman was not given.
Mm-hmm.
There was no Bruton violation. Delatorre's confession, as it came in, was restricted to himself and an unnamed other gang member. And, of course, the judge instructed the jury that his statement could only be considered against him and not against anybody else. And so I think that there was no Bruton violation. Instructions took care of any possible prejudice. And
I'm just trying to suggest you were playing with fire, mm-hmm. the way that was handled.
I recognize the risk of
in a two-month trial.
Mm-hmm. We recognize the risk of asking the question in that way, Judge. We certainly do. So, well, for all these reasons, and the reasons we say in our brief, we'd ask that the court affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fulton. Mr. Carlson, Mr. Carlson, you don't have any time left, but I'll give you a minute.
Thank you. In response to Judge Hamilton's question to me earlier, it's page 5 of the February 6 transcript.
Thank you.
In which Mr. Delatorre's lawyer said, the marshal came back and said Mr. Delatorre does not have a lawyer and would not see him. Ms. Schatz, who represented Benabi, said that Benabi refused to see him. And then Mr. Kling, who was the lawyer for Mr. Benabi, said, and let me throw one thing into the equation, he did ask the marshal how he can get his civilian clothing. Judge Castillo's response was, that's interesting. So I wanted to provide that to the court.
Thank you.
I would also say that this court in two cases has held that errors of the Sixth Amendment and one in a right to counsel of choice is not subject to is structural error and is not subject to harmless error analysis, and that is the Smith case. And in the Thompson case, where the judge was not present and did a video conference of a sentencing hearing, found that that was not harmless as well. And I would just lastly say that it was the Supreme Court who said defendants get two chances. I was not suggesting that. I was quoting the Allen case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Beal, you can have another minute if you like.
Thank you, Judge. I just repeat myself.
All right. All right. Well, thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.